you very welcome to the RTÉ Rugby podcast this week. As news confirmed, I guess what we all suspected, that the Champions Cup rounds of 3 and 4 will not go ahead over the next 2 weeks. Very disappointing, obviously, but the bigger picture has to be taken in. And the big question is now, will the Six Nations proceed as planned? Delighted to be joined by Donal Lenihan, by Bernard Jackman and by Wes Liddy, as always. Gents, you're very welcome. Donal, disappointing we don't have a Munster Claremont to look forward to this weekend, among every other game planned in the Champions Cup. But I guess the French government put their foot down and EPCR had no alternative, really, but to concede that these rounds had to fall by the wayside.
Yeah, look, I think it was well flagged to you last week. I think we even spoke about it. You had those incidents with Bayonne after the game against Leicester, Toulon refusing to play against Scarlett a couple of weeks ago. So this is festering in the background. And to be fair, you can understand why. I mean, the cases in both the UK and Ireland have gone through the roof in recent times. So no surprise, really, that the government have got involved. I noticed the La Rochelle, Ron Nogaris team, they pulled out of their domestic game against Racing, originally supposed to be played Saturday, postponed till Sunday. And they had testing on Monday, and 15 players, I think 5 of their senior squad, 10 of their esquires, tested positive. So they've had to close down their training camp. So look, I think it was inevitable. I suppose that immediately reflected on what's going to happen with the Six Nations. And I know we'll talk about that down the road. But look, I think it was well flagged. It's a question now in terms of EPCR with the challenge and the Champions Cup. What are they going to do now? What adjustments are they going to make in order to finish the tournament? To be awful to think after that great Munster performance in Claremont that you get no reward for it. But look, we just have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah, and look, there's a number of, I guess, alternatives that have been proposed, Bernard, and we're not going to get too deep into this because we don't really know. One of the suggestions that seems quite popular, certainly seemed to take and hold a lot among members of the media, is that instead of a home and away quarterfinal, we will have one quarterfinal based on the rankings after one more group game, quarterfinal, semi-final, final, which would seem to make an awful lot of sense and probably the least disruption, which I think the European Champions Cup organisers at the moment will be pushing for.
Yeah, look, that certainly makes sense. They're going to have to try and, reformat the best way they possibly can. I had actually heard from France the more likely solution was to get rid of the quarterfinals altogether. So obviously, with this format, there was a home and away quarterfinal planned. And the talk last week certainly was coming from France, and I'm not sure how it would be accepted by everybody else, was what they would just basically go to top two teams in each conference straight into semifinals. And they would then pick up two weekends as such. So again, if that happens, it's all, it shows you how important that fast start was in this competition. And someone like Exeter, which would obviously won't make the top two if that's the case, given that they had to give up, a match because of COVID and got 0 points. So I think all the tournament organisers are, they're in contingency mode the whole time now. And it's react on a weekly or daily basis to the health concerns and just trying to keep the competition alive in some format. So it's kicked the touch till after the Six Nations. So there's plenty of time to try and, I suppose, reorganize it if it goes back onto into the reckoning, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess, Wes, it also underlines really the pecking order of where European rugby is at, really. It comes behind the domestic league, certainly as far as the French and the English are concerned. It comes behind the Six Nations. That's a given, obviously, given the money involved. We'd like to have it finished off, if at all possible, but I guess nobody really knows if the tournament is going to proceed at all.
No, I hadn't heard what Bernard said about the French suggestion, which makes a lot of sense in some ways, in that I suppose on one hand, if you're it's very harsh on teams who played totally different standards of opposition to kind of grade them now based on two pool games, if you were to go straight to semi-final following completing the group. So I nearly think the other way of playing a last 16 at least gives maybe teams like Exeter, at least another bite at the cherry before the tournament would plough on. So I think that'd be the best option if you're to fit it in that current four-match window.
Probably most...
Yeah, I think... I think it'd be a disaster if they went straight to semi-finals, because you look even at the way the the two pools were devised in the first place. You had teams in tier one and in tier four were put into one pool. So obviously the second pool where you had tier two and tier three teams was a lot more competitive. So I think it'd be a disaster if they went straight to a semi-final. I think it would be, it's a pity that the home and away quarter-final format, which I quite liked, I think that would have been brilliant to see. You could imagine going away to France in the first leg of a quarter-final and you're 12 or 14, you lose by 14 points, but you've got the chance to come back to the RDS or Thomond Park or Ravenhill or wherever with a chance to overturn that. And we saw that in the championship playoffs in England in the past number of years, you know, when the championship team is fighting to get promotion to the Gallagher Premiership. They had those playoffs in a home and away, and you know, even teams that I had no interest in, I remember looking at them, but the fact that they were chasing that points differential was brilliant. I think it would have brought a different dimension to it, but I definitely think if they're going to lose that home and away quarter final, then the best route to go down is the top eight in each pool, because at least you're getting reward for winning your opening two games in the pool games that took place. So No, I think it'd be a disaster to go straight to semi-finals.
And Bert, as you well know, the most French thing ever the other day. So literally at 12 o'clock, the French government says, absolutely no way, you're not travelling. So therefore, European games are off. But half an hour later, here's our squad for the Six Nations. We're very much looking forward to the Six Nations. Sorry, I thought it was the most French thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, well, look, when I heard Bernard Laporte come out last Thursday and say, the Six Nations will go ahead, you're pretty much getting what the Ministry of Sport were going to say. I mean, he is probably the most closely linked president or CEO of any federation to the government, having been a minister from sport himself. So, look, there was bad feeling in the top 14 in general about playing these two rounds of Europe, and it wasn't from Racing or Toulouse, teams who have a chance, or La Rochelle. It was effectively the teams who have nothing to play for, the Montpelliers, the the Bayons, etc. So it's no surprise to me that they've been pushed. I'd love to see it being back. I don't think the two semi-finals, going straight to semi-finals, is their best option or the fairest option at all. It's just what the talk was from France. But at least they're keen to have the Six Nations. There is a feeling in France that they would prefer to be in France as in totality. But I think that there's an argument that, given the fact that it's just six teams, it's much easier to stay in a bubble. And I think it's a lot easier to manage that properly and keep the French happy from a medical point of view than it was to have 14, you know, French teams either playing away or hosting non-French opposition. So I think it'll go ahead as scheduled with games in Dublin, Cardiff, you know, Edinburgh, etc.
And I think, Donal, on that, you know, I know the French government are again insisting on more assurances around health and safety for the players before they give the green light to this. But even the prospect of having it in one place, but the economic cost of that, of having an Irish squad, for say, based in France or based in England for 6-7 weeks, is absolutely huge. I mean, who's going to pick up the bill for that?
Yeah, look, I just can't see that happening. I don't see any reason why, you know, they can't fly in the day before the match, have their bubble, get in, get out straight away after the match. Even if they have to charter planes, so be it. But look, I don't think that's going to happen. I do think it was ironic that Laporte, as Bernard said, he has his hands in every single pie, that he can come out independently of everyone in France and say, oh, don't worry about the Six Nations, that's definitely going to go ahead. I mean, like, how the other five countries might want to have a little bit of an input in this as well, but that's the way he operates, and he seems to get away with it.
I really admire him, I have to say.
Yeah, well, I must say, I remember coming across him when he was coach of France. He was the best coach that France had in the professional era. But look, I mean, he is what he is. He won two or three Heineken Cups, whatever it was, with Toulon. I personally, you know, we all want to see the Six Nations going ahead, but you want to see it in a safe environment. But the key issue here is you're talking about six teams. You're talking between Challenge and Champions Cup, 14 teams in France having to travel all over the place. So the dynamics of that are totally different. I think from a financial point of view, all the countries want the Six Nations to go ahead because it is the cash cow. Even though if it was postponed and played later, they need the money now. All the unions are hemorrhaging money big time. So therefore, I think the Six Nations will go ahead. I think they'll come out and they'll say, look, one of the issues they had in the French clubs was that the testing for the Champions Cup games was done 5 days in advance of teams travelling. They wanted that brought forward closer to the event 3 days before. I think that's now going to happen with the Six Nations as well. But I think, look, the wider issue here is there's a huge amount of self-interest in that the two weekends in Europe have been cancelled, right? We've seen that the top 14 in France came out immediately and they rescheduled. They brought forward some of their top 14 games, which is great because that might leave a little window open for the Champions Cup later on in the year. Likewise, we see the Pro 14 are now playing games that had been cancelled, the Munster-Leinster game being one of them, which is great. So we get that match in 2 weeks' time. So again, there'll be opportunities maybe to free weekends down the road. But what do the Gallagher Premiership do? They come out and they give everybody 2 weeks off. So therefore, that opportunity of opening up time later on in the season is gone. And again, it appears to be driven, that decision was driven by self-interest within the clubs in England, because a lot of clubs who won't have their players for that two-month window of the Six Nations, they wanted to play in this 2 weeks, whereas other clubs who wouldn't have as many players in the England squad said, nah, we'd play those games during the Six Nations window. So it's self-interest, and this has been a problem. I thought, given the financial issues that rugby is facing over the past 12 months, that would bring the interested parties closer together. You know, this talk about a global season, everything seemed to be going down that route at one stage. But now everybody's gone off and running in their own directions. There's very little leadership from the top in rugby in this pandemic. And I think when you had an opportunity to come together in these desperate times and get a consensus, if anything, it seems to have gone the other direction.
Absolutely. And whereas the lack of joined up thinking as well pushes more problems down the line. I know there's a petition from Lions fans at the moment not to abandon the Tour de South Africa this summer. I think they have over 2,000 signatures. I don't know what a petition can do, to be honest with you, in the midst of a global pandemic. It's quite fanciful, but maybe they feel that they can do nothing else. But because there's no joined up thinking and the Premiership now are taking a 2 week break as against the Pro 14 and Top 14, which moved fixtures forward, Wes is gone. So maybe Bernard, you can take this one. It does seem like the Lions Tour just grows ever more into doubt with all of these pushbacks.
Yeah, I read an article this morning saying, you know, the unions don't want to play in 2022 because obviously it will interfere with the summer tours, and the best options to play it in the Northern Hemisphere. I still think, and I don't as the expert on Lions, but I still think it'd be pushed. I think it'd be pushed to 2022. I don't see it. I'm not really that interested in it, to be honest, if it's played in Dublin. I know it'd be great novelty-wise, but it's not really a Lions tour for me. And I read in one of the Japanese journals talking around how they'd be willing to host it over there in a bio bubble. It's just, there's all kinds of mad stuff being floated around. But look, I think the Lions tour has to happen at some stage. I think, one, to keep the tradition going, because it's a phenomenal tradition. Two, to get money back into the game. But, you know, I personally would say it's worth having second string international teams traveling on summer tours, minus their Lions players, to have it in some kind of manner that's close to what we know of, i.e. the team touring South Africa, some people in the crowd, in the stadiums at least, and the host nation having home advantage. That would be my preference. And I know the big issue is actually Wales has to travel to South Africa next summer. And obviously that's a very tricky one to compensate. Whereas Ireland could go to New Zealand without their Lions players. England would have to do without their Lions players. But that the Welsh and how they manage without having an opponent might be very difficult. But yeah, like I said, I think Donal is far more capable of answering this than me. But I would hate to see it being played in the home nations this summer.
I agree with you, Donal. I don't know if you saw this last night, but somebody put up, Sky Sports put up a clip of you in the dressing room after 2001 when the third test was done. And you spoke to the players as manager, And, you know, the emotion in your voice, I guess the emotion of the faces of the players as well, and the atmosphere in the dressing room. It just, I'd had a couple of glasses of wine and maybe I'm going through the menopause or something like that, but I was got a bit emotional watching it myself and I wasn't even there. So I just thought to myself, you can't replicate that with a home line store here without travelling abroad and the sense of unity and difference that that gives you, right?
No, you can't. I mean, it's, look, as I say, Lions Tour is right down through since 1888, the first tourist to ever go abroad. And it's all about taking on the opposition in their backyard against all the odds, as I've spoken about before. But I've thought about this a lot because there's so many vested interests in it. It's a very tricky one for the Lions to sort out. The first problem you have is, and I can understand the unions giving out about their players gone 15 months out from the World Cup. But the same people who will be making the decision in the Lions boardroom are like the CEOs of the various unions sit around that table. So if I'm the CEO of the rugby union and Eddie Jones is down my throat saying there is no way that I'm going to tour Australia in 2022 without my Lions players. So their CEO is immediately compromised when he goes into that meeting to decide what the Lions are going to do. So the whole, again, you have the people who are forced to make this decision have different agendas compromised by their involvement in their own unions. The financial issue of the Lions, like park the romance, park the amount of travelling fans who go and the way the thing has exploded, if you like, since that first test in the Gabba in 2001, when all of a sudden 20,000 Lions supporters almost appeared overnight. I mean, I'll never forget coming out of the dressing room with Martin Johnson at the time, Australia, and we'll go into how this happened another day, but we were in a dressing room at one end of the Gabba in Brisbane. John Eales was captain of Australia at the other end, and both captains, I remember going out for the toss with Jono. Both captains met at the halfway line to toss the coin. And, you know, we had been in a dressing room underneath the bowls of the stand and we came up to this unbelievable scene of these, all the Lions support. And it was phenomenal, incredible moment. I remember Johnson going back into the dressing room just saying, lads, wait till you go out and you see teams didn't warm up on the pitch at that stage. So it was incredible. But going back, the problem is the Lions, they play a huge financial role in the Southern Hemisphere, keeping Southern Hemisphere rugby alive. Mm-hmm. 2013 Lions Tour bailed out Australia, who were on the brink of bankruptcy. They made so much money that kept them going for another 4 or 5 years. South Africa are in the same situation now. They badly need the Lions Tour to go ahead to keep them alive financially. The Lions, you see, the problem is the four home unions who were equal partners in the Lions, they actually make very little money out of a Lions Tour. I think they'd be lucky to make €1 million each, okay? But the quid pro quo for that is that the Southern Hemisphere teams, the All Blacks, they continue to come up here in November to fill our stadia on the basis that they know once every 12 years they get this massive financial return from the Lions. So therefore, if South Africa don't get their full Lions Tour and the money that ensues from that, what incentive do they have to come up here the following year and fill our stadium? Yeah. So it's a very complex issue. I've been thinking about it in terms of, you know, certainly playing tests over here in England and Ireland, it's not the same. But I think that finance may dictate that there is a possibility now that that could happen, whereas I was thinking even 2 weeks ago, you couldn't allow it to happen because
it's not what the Lions is.
Different. It's not what the Lions is, but it become a least worse scenario. And we are in unprecedented times. It'll be very interesting to see which way these decisions move over the course of the next couple of weeks, because we're expecting that the Lions are going to make some announcement in relation to South Africa, if not by the end of this month, then by the middle of next month. So it's going to be fascinating to see how the whole thing unfurls.
It is. And as I say, look, nobody can predict which way it's going to go. I did read an article yesterday in the Irish Daily Mail and in The Guardian, Bernard, that suggests that a deal has been done with CVC which will provide a huge cash injection to the home union. So £365 million by investor CVC Capital as Rugby Tournament sells 14.5% of its commercial rights with a five-year deal to be confirmed later on this month. And just I guess the highlights are Six Nations set for much needed cash boost with the sale of commercial rights, 14.5% of their rights sold to CVC Capital Partners for £365 million. And all the details of a five-year deal have been agreed. It'll be divvied out, that money is, in relation to, I guess, the strength of the union. So England will get the most, followed by France and Ireland and Wales and so on. On the face of it, it's a much-needed cash injection for unions that are struggling amidst the pandemic and everything else. But the question further down the line is, what is this going to mean for rugby as a whole? And the suggestion now that it will almost certainly go behind a paywall and be sold to one of these subscription channels like cricket has been. We don't know what the makeup of that. We don't know the details of that. But certainly CVC are going to want to see a credible return for their investment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the first competition they bought into was the Gallagher Premiership. And they've just done a new TV deal. They've stayed on BT Sport. I don't think there was a massive uptick, but it's a solid contract. So that's done. Look, at the next one is the Six Nations. That's the cash cow. That's why I think they were so keen to get involved in buying into the Pro 14 and getting a stake in that. So they and they've a chance to be part of the negotiations for the Six Nations. And you know, all the rumors, all the talk is, you know, and it's obvious for them to get the most bang for their buck, it has to go behind a paywall or at least part of it. So, you know, it's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out. The value
we have our own self-interest, Bernard, here, obviously with RT and stuff like that. So, yeah. Cards on the table, and that's pretty obvious. But, like, I'm looking at this from a historical point of view. If you take cricket as a prime example, and what cricket going behind closed doors has done to the sport in terms of recognition, in terms of the public's affinity with the sport, it has deadened hugely over the last 2 years because it has gone to Sky Sports. Similarly with Formula One, there's a similar path here. If rugby goes exclusively behind a paywall for the Six Nations Championship, well, commercially, it might make sense for some of the home unions. For the sport itself, will it not suffer hugely as a result?
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of growth, popularity, sponsorship building sponsorship awareness, activation. I will, of course. I mean, even you look at the current state of club rugby in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, I meet lots of people who say they've given up whatever subscription to Sky Sports because there's no rugby anymore. They haven't taken on, you know, the other providers to the same extent. They don't know what channel to watch a game on. Like, it's not really helping. And yeah, I think it will be sad. I think they've got to try and find some kind of balance where there is a certain amount of free to air. And again, you know, you said, you know, we're biased here on this, but in terms of, it's not rocket science, in terms of actually growing the game, you know, you want kids, you want fans to have easy access to your premium product. And our premium product is the Six Nations. So it's interesting, just, you know, anecdotally, the Sharks were sold last week to an American consortium, the Sharks in South Africa. And by all accounts, they picked it up for a song. I think the value of professional rugby teams or competitions at the moment must be at an all-time low. So hopefully they got a good deal from that private equity and they didn't have to, I suppose, renegotiate at the last minute because the value of our sport at the moment in terms of commercial prices is pretty bad because no one knows where the future is. No one knows, you know, where the income's going to come.
Exactly. I think, Donald, from the union's point of view, they managed to stick with the original sum around the original percentage of rights having to be given up, which they will see as a success. From CVC's point of view, my understanding is, from what I've read, that they have insisted on a COVID clause whereby if games or fixtures are forfeited because of pandemic, that gets money back from their point of view. So they've obviously looked after their own interests there. But in relation to the bigger picture of rugby, if a deal can be done whereby there is a paywall element to the Six Nations alongside a free-to-air element, maybe all the home unions get to show their own games free-to-air, the rest goes behind a paywall. Is that the best case scenario we can hope for, do you think?
Yeah, I think it is. Look, I think that has to be compromised somewhere. You go back and the point you both made, Formula One and cricket in terms of being behind the paywall. I remember going back in the early 2000s, Sky had the exclusive rights for all of England's games. Mm-hmm. Okay. So therefore, when Ireland went to Twickenham, that was the one game that you couldn't see. And I remember when England won the World Cup, there was, a survey done afterwards. As in those years leading up to the 2003 World Cup, Sky had the exclusive rights for all of England's games. But as a consequence, when England won the World Cup in 2003, the viewership, the numbers viewing those games that England were playing, I'm talking about your Six Nations games even, mm-hmm. your Autumn Internationals and all those. Their audience was so small, nobody had a clue of anybody on the English team. The likes of Johnny Wilkinson, who was probably the biggest name in international rugby at the time, nobody knew, outside of your immediate rugby supporters, nobody knew anything about him, really, because he was that England rugby team, an outstanding rugby team, were hidden behind this paywall. And that has been a problem in cricket. I'm not a cricket fan, but in the Cricket World Cup final, final against New Zealand, they showed it live on terrestrial television. And the numbers obviously ballooned, went through the roof overnight. The interest in cricket was almost rekindled. So I think there is a lesson there. I think there has to be compromise. Look, there's no getting away from the fact the CVCs of this world are coming in to get a massive return on their investment, be it 5 or 10 years down the road. How are they going to do that? They're going to try and grow the revenues that are generated both through broadcast and sponsorship. But I think there have to be some compromise. And I think the model that you're talking about there is the one that could potentially happen. So in other words, you'll have a paywall. So one, be it BT or Sky, they'll have the exclusive rights to every match in the Six Nations Championship. But there's a possibility, let's say that RTE or TV3, whoever wins that particular, they may get the rights to just the Irish games alone. Mm. Now, the debate will be then, the ideal scenario is that you'd be able to show those games live, or the downside, but maybe the best worst case scenario, is there's delayed transmission. We see that a little bit at the moment. TG Cahir have the rights of some games in the Pro 14, not all of them live, but they can show some of them on a delayed transmission. So look, there are possibilities there. None of them are ideal. If anything, the financial black hole that rugby is facing now, it's playing into the hands of the CVCs and the other venture capitalists of this world. Like I was unaware until Bert said it there, that the Sharks have been bought out by some American club. How does that happen, you wonder? Because the Sharks are under the control of the South African Rugby Union. So the equivalent would be an American conglomerate coming in to take an interest in Leinster.
Yeah.
How can you take a controlling interest in an entity like Leinster, which is run by the IRFU? So, I mean, look, I think the sport, professional rugby, is at a serious crossroads right now. We celebrated the 25-year anniversary of the professional game last year. But I think, the teething problems that have been building are going to be brought to a head by the financial challenges that the game is facing right now.
Okay, so look, just to pick up on last weekend, Bernard, and the two Interpros we had, Munster just hanging on at the end against Connacht. Connacht could and maybe should have won the game, but for some poor game management, if we're being brutally honest about it. I'm sure Andy Friend was pulling his hair out at the final whistle there. They could have stolen victory from Munster. And the previous night, Leinster, first 40 minutes, not great, but then, seemed to play well enough to do the job against Ulster. Just in terms of an overall form point of view now with the Irish provinces, happy enough, do you think, Andy Farrell, watching it, that the players that he will be relying on come Six Nations, if indeed it does go ahead, are in a reasonable run of form? Or is it hard to really judge, given that it's a provincial games against each other rather than an Irish camp at the moment?
I think it's hard to judge. Certainly the Munster players, going back to the last, probably the game against Claremont, they all pitched up. And then obviously they had they all get a little bit of a rest over Christmas. I think the fact that they managed to fit that Leinster-Munster game in for Saturday week is a huge boost to Andy Farrell. And it's a huge boost to Irish rugby fans, because for the first time in a long time, you're going to see two full-strength teams play in that big Irish derby, which is, it hasn't happened for a while. So that'll get the lads ready. I mean, they actually needed to play this weekend and next weekend, just given the way they're managed. So they, getting one game is is super important. But I think the intensity of that level, that game will be at a level that they're used to in Europe, and that'll set them up. It's hard to know where they're at. I think they're all in good form, to be honest. But I think the Ulster-Leinster game, Ulster missed an opportunity. I mean, Leinster were rusty that first half. To go in 9-5 up at halftime in the RDS is rare. And they just came out that third quarter and just folded as soon as Leinster started to pick up the pressure. And that's what Leinster do to you, and credit to them. But I think the big losers last weekend, Connacht were outplayed for 75 minutes. And suddenly, you know, through positive play from them and some probably switching off from Munster, found themselves with a chance to win it. But I think if you're Johan van Graan, you know, you'd feel that you have Connacht's number, which is what they'd expect. But I think Dan McFarland will be very disappointed with how, you know, Ulster still look to be a long way behind Leinster, despite the fact that in the Pro 14, they're on an unbelievable run. And that's the challenge for them. But yeah, I think the lads are all in okay form. The challenge is to step it up to the next level to be able to beat England and France, because they're the teams that are the barometer at the moment.
I asked you last week about Jack Carty Dole and, you know, the mindset that he needs to bring to get more consistent. I was watching the game with a couple of family members here last week. We were all looking forward to it. I said, right, come on, Jack, show us what you're made of here. He missed that early penalty. He had a very kind of sloppy first half as well, and just not the performance levels that we saw against Leinster. Now, I understand from the highs of what he did the previous week at the RDS, the man of the match performance, it's very difficult to get up to that level again the following week. I just was disappointed, I guess, that we didn't see more from him on that occasion.
Yeah, look, I think it was a game really that he needed to back up that performance that he put in against Leinster. No, to be fair to him, Munster had Connacht's measure up front in that entire first half. Line speed and defence was incredible. They really suffocated, I thought, Connacht at halfback. But things like the penalty, I mean, that's an individual thing. That was a very kickable penalty. They're your bread and butter. Connacht, you know, that was an opportunity for them to get on the board early on. They're scores that you just have to nail, I think, to be fair to him. He did turn around in the end when they got that try. He had to get the touchline conversion to put them within the 6 points, and yeah, he got that. So therefore, it's in his armory. It's just that consistency is what he needs. But I thought, to be fair to him, everything that he got was coming back on top of him. So it was difficult from that point of view. Look, I thought really, you know, you go back to the... if Connacht had won that game, it would have, like, Munster would be scratching their heads for a long time wondering, how in the name of God did we get ourselves into this position? Yeah. But then you go back and, you know, you see so much about, you know, rugby and the processes. The players continually talk about processes and, you know, stick to the script. And, you know, we know exactly what's in every player, where he's supposed to be. You know, it's like chess on a table. But the bottom line is they found themselves in a position, 13 men against 15. They have an attacking 5-meter scrum. And they attack down the blind side, the narrowest area of the field that I could have gone into. If Munster... Yeah. were to buy a decision that they'd ask Connacht to do in that particular time, that's exactly what they would have asked them to do. So, yeah. I mean, you know, you talk about spontaneity, you talk about empowering players, you talk about reacting to the situation that you find yourself in. Like, Connacht couldn't have made a worse decision at that point in time. But look, there it is. Like Birch, I mean, I'm hoping that that Munster-Leinster game, I think, will be a cracker. And I think there's even another element to it in that I think Munster will look at the fact that it could be their best chance to beat Leinster, in the context that if they beat them in that game on Saturday week, it'll probably put them out. It certainly will play into Ulster's hands, yeah, and give Ulster a better chance than Leinster to top their conference, which means that Munster could then be playing Ulster in the final. So, like, I would say Munster, would they have a better chance of beating Leinster next week than they will if it's a Pro 14 final down the road?
Yeah.
Make up massive, your own mind.
Massive, so
I think it becomes a huge game from that point of view, Birch.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's the reality, the best chance. And that's why Ulster would be absolutely gutted. They allowed Leinster get the bonus point in the 74th minute and then didn't score themselves in the 80th minute, you know, when they had an opportunity in their 22 to... to get a bonus point themselves, because I think Ulster still have a card to play. And I know that they may be a little bit off Leinster, but their draw is quite favourable. Leinster have to go to Munster, and Leinster have to go to Ulster a little bit later on. So if Munster can beat Leinster this weekend, even though Leinster are picking up 5 points every game except that Connacht defeat, it's still very much to play for. And to knock them out, the reality is they're going to have to go to Ravenhill, I think, without their internationals. We're still waiting on the fixtures, but more than likely it'd be with some kind of a second-string team, which we know are still very strong. But it's a huge opportunity for Munster. And like, they must be licking their lips at the chance. It's just a pity there's no crowd there, because I think that match in Thomond Park Saturday week will be, it'll be skin and hair flying.
Yeah, can't wait for it. Finally, lads, I know it's kind of old news now, but I wanted to get your thoughts because it happened after the podcast last week. Donal, Paul O'Connell to take up the forwards coaching role with Ireland. Simon Easterby is going to shift predominantly to defence. And I guess, from Andy Farrell's point of view, to have someone like Paul O'Connell to come in and try and shore up the line-out, which has been malfunctioning now for the past year, really, if you look at the Six Nations back in March and the Autumn Nations Cup as well. It looks on paper like a good appointment. What's your view?
Yeah, well, look, I've actually written about that in the Examiner today in terms of look, O'Connell is an iconic figure in Irish rugby. But he's not just this kind of, fella giving the speeches in the dressing room and all that. He's technically a very astute rugby brain. I know there's been sort of people are highlighting the fact that he doesn't have a huge amount of rugby coaching behind them. But I think he's going to be involved in specific areas that he has just incredible rugby knowledge on. You're talking about the line-out, the maul, and the breakdown. All three areas in which he excelled. I think he will have watched Ireland over the past year, 2 years, and he will have seen issues there that he feels that he could have an impact on. And I've no doubt that he will. I suppose the challenge is there's only sort of 3 or 4 weeks between now and hopefully the opening game of the Six Nations. If you look at the areas that we're talking about, the line-out and the maul in particular, that is an area where Ireland have regressed massively, in my opinion, over the last 12 months. So I think he will have an impact in that area. It's going to, if you were a player and you heard that Paul O'Connell is coming in and he's going to take over that area, I can't but feel that you'd be enthused by that. Outside of his ability as a player, you know that he'll bring a work ethic, that he'll bring a technical ability and a sort of a forensic analysis that is going to make you a better player. Like, I'm thinking immediately for the likes of James Ryan. I think it'll be a huge plus for him to have somebody like O'Connell to sort of pick his brain. We saw James Ryan, the whole area around calling a line-out has become a very nuanced area. I mean, you have to react to things as they develop throughout the game. I think James Ryan had responsibility for that in that game against England and Twickenham in the Nations Cup. It didn't go particularly well. So I think it's a massive opportunity for him to learn from O'Connell. But it's a question of, he's only 3 or 4 weeks before the opening game. Is that enough to sort of make your impact? I think the very fact that he's going to be in there, in that bubble, in camp, available to players right throughout that Six Nations period, it has to be a plus. I mean, I don't see any major downside from it, really.
And Bernard, what we know of Paul O'Connell as a player, certainly, and anecdotally afterwards, is that he would put everything into this role. I know people have held up Stade Francais as a stick to beat him with, while saying, look, it didn't exactly work out there. But from what I understand, and you'll have much more information on this, Heineken Meyer is not the easiest guy to go and work under for someone like Paul O'Connell, who's very attention and detail driven. And he probably wasn't able to transfer that as well as he would have liked, or as much as he would have liked, in the situation with Stade Francais, which is why it didn't work out ultimately.
Yeah, look, Stade Francais is a very tricky club, and it was going through a period of change. They were trying to move on some, I suppose, legacy players there. Parise was one of them. Yeah. They retired a few players who didn't want to retire because they weren't performing, and the dressing room became quite fractured. And to I suppose, judge Paul or Mike Prendergast and Paul were there together. And if you're going to say Paul failed, just say Mike Prendergast failed. But Mike is a very good coach who's now doing an incredible job at Racing, because in Racing he has you know, a group who want to get better, who want to win things, who are united. And unfortunately for that period when Paul was in Stade, the dressing room wasn't together. And in that club, that's been the case for a long time. You know, a very talented group of players, you know, high earners, big profiles. But over the last 15, 20 years, you know, they haven't had the success that their, you know, the club was built on back in the early stages of the European Cup. And, you know, there's only so much Paul could do as an assistant there. And certainly from what I heard from players who worked under him was they loved his coaching. You know, they loved his detail. They loved his ability to make things simple for them, to make them better. And that's a huge positive. And I think, you know, with the under-20s, if you look back at it, if you look at that group that they had, that age grade, it wasn't a brilliant group. You know, a lot of the players from that group haven't come on to do great things. They've had a couple of very good players. So I wouldn't read too much into it. And people need to understand, and Donal would understand this, is that probably your lineup caller is the most like a coach of any player in an organization. So, for example, with Leo in Leinster, when John O'Gibbs was there and Mike Brewer was the forwards coach, Leo would come in on a Monday morning with the plan. You know, Leo would pretty much run the lineouts, you know, in a walkthrough on a Monday afternoon at the session, and the coach would supervise it and add his bits and pieces. But the Leos, the Bortwicks, the Paul O'Connells, you know, they were effectively a coach. So that's why it's, you know, in terms of experience of hours coaching, yeah, he might not have the same experience as a Graham Rowntree, for example. But while he was playing, he was effectively a coach and a very shrewd rugby brain, and also very shrewd in terms of getting that balance right between, you know, old school and new school, you know, so process driven, but understands that you need to be ready mentally, physically, your mindset needs to be right. And for the areas that he's going to do, you know, obviously the line of calling as such is a, you know, it's calm, collected, understanding, you know, the movements, understanding the opposition, etc. But when it comes to line-out mauling, you know, there's a lot of old school brute mentality that you need. And also when it comes to the breakdown, yeah, technically you need to be good, but also you need to have a bit of an edge about you physically. So I think the two areas that he's three areas that he's taken responsibility for haven't been performing. It allowed Simon go and do the defence, which probably is a job in itself, and that needs a little bit of time because it's not probably where it needs to be. And so I think the coaches, they probably needed someone else in there, and I think Paul is a great call.
Okay, well, look, gents, we'll leave it on that. And we do have next weekend Leinster, Munster to look forward to. There's very little rugby on TV this weekend. I know Glasgow are playing Edinburgh, but having watched a bit of Glasgow at Edinburgh last while, maybe you're better off watching Ireland's Fittest Family for your entertainment on Saturday night. Anyway, that is your rugby for the weekend. My thanks to Bernard and to Donal. We lost Wes along the way. Surely be back next week. Thanks for listening, as always.